ANZ Voices welcomes you to the Business of Bloodstock podcast with co-hosts Justin Darcy and Taylor Dyke.
Welcome to episode 18 of the Business of Bloodstock podcast, proudly sponsored by Jimmy O'Muller's Avesta Bloodstock. Joining me today is co-host Taylor Dyke in what is a very special episode. Today we're ecstatic to have special guest John Stewart joining the podcast. A household name in the bloodstock and racing industry, John certainly made an impact across the 2024 Australian sales season, famously going toe-to-toe with Debbie Kapitas on the $10 million Winx Filly at Easter this year. From Toyota to the sales ring to the racetrack with Resolute Racing and now to the business of bloodstock, welcome to the podcast, John.
Thank you. Good to be here.
The day-to-day of a private equity firm is pretty different to the day-to-day operations of managing a racing and breeding operation. Could you tell us a little bit about your journey and how you first engaged with horse racing? I understand you started off as a line worker at Toyota before taking multiple management positions and then moving up within the business.
Yeah, so I live in Kentucky, and so a lot of people don't know it, but Toyota's largest factory in the world is in Kentucky, and it's a pretty interesting place. I started there. I actually dropped out of college and went to work on the night shift there, putting bumpers on cars when I was 19, and I ended up, you know, getting my undergraduate degree as I was working, and then I got promoted through the organization and ended up being dispatched to Europe to run Toyota's manufacturing over there. And then 17 years ago, I got recruited into private equity. Toyota's world renowned for like the Toyota production system. It's a way that you run efficiently in your factories. I actually authored a book on how to make your factory run more efficient. And so I moved into private equity and started working for a firm in New York, and over a 10-year career became a partner there, and we were a successful firm. And so I decided to start my own firm in 2017 and left and started my own firm based in Lexington in 2018. And, now I own, I have over $3.5 billion of assets that I manage and have owned over 200 factories all over the world, in my firm. So, I've had some good success. And so that's part of the story of how I got into horse racing, because I moved to the Lexington area because of Toyota. And so my first racing experience was going to Keeneland and being a part of the activity here. And Australia is the closest that you can get to the racing experience in Kentucky. It's a special place. I've always enjoyed racing, always was a little intimidated by the thought of getting into racing and being an owner, because it just seems like, there's just a lot of things that you don't understand and you don't know. And so I met Gavin, who is works with me on my team, and I met him in 2021, actually, and we were going to buy a horse together. And then I was married at the time, and my ex-wife didn't want to, so I had to back out. And he was really mad because he'd been to the sale and like looked at all these horses. So I paid him his commission anyway, even though we didn't buy a horse. And make a long story short, my wife kind of kicked me to the curb, and she put me out. And so the first thing I did was like, okay, we're buying a horse. So Gavin bought me a horse in 2022, and that horse was in training. And then as I were coming into 2023, I had told him and Chelsea, who I had met in 2023, that I was going to, want to buy a few more horses, and told him I was going to spend $1 million at the sale and to look for a couple horses. And then, the rest is kind of history.
In terms of that, your early career working at Toyota, going into private equity, and then starting this racing and breeding venture, some of those principles that you both learned and experienced, have you been able to utilize them in your business?
Oh, absolutely. Everybody, as soon as I got in the racing business, everybody's like, you got to watch it. These people will take advantage of you. It's like a cutthroat world, these horse racing people. And I'm like, have you heard of private equity? It can be pretty cutthroat. There's a lot of sharks out there. And so, it really helped me a lot. I collect cars as well. And so I participate in a lot of auctions. I collect art and, different items. So I like the whole auction experience. I find it a good way to buy things. I was able to kind of bring that in. There's a whole mental game to buying horses and buying things at auction. And so, a lot of people don't really understand my tactic, but it works really well for me. I have been in some of the top sales and buying some of the top horses, and you know, I enjoy, you know, that experience, and you know, it's been a lot of fun. So, but yeah, no, absolutely. The skills have, you know, helped me to adapt. You know, I use a lot of data analytics in my private equity job. I used a lot of data analytics as a horse player. So I spent 30 years really understanding horses, jockeys, trainers, you know, conditions, and, you know, all those different factors. And a lot of people saw me coming into the industry as a new person, but I've been around the industry for 30 years. And I think there's a lot of horse players that understand the horse industry better than some owners, to be honest with you. And they definitely use more data than some of the owners do. And so as I started to get into the industry, I really focused on the data side of things. And that's really helped me have a lot of success in the business. I mean, in our first year, we've already, you know, won 9 stakes races, you know, which is, you know, quite an accomplishment. You know, when you just look at the statistics, 80% of my horses that run today are running in stakes races. So, you know, we've done a good job of like using the data to buck some of the trends, because it tends to be the majority of horses, you know, tend to make it in stakes races, even with some of the leading programs that are out there. And, you know, we've been able to do something a little bit different. And so that's what I'm interested in doing, is not doing it the way everybody else does it. I'm going to do it a little different.
You mentioned there about that stat that you have 80% of your horses running in stakes races. That's, you know, that's a really fast growth rate from when, you know, the Resolute Racing brand also started. And it, last year, of course, you bought an 850-acre property and expanded that to 1,000 acres. From broodmares, you've got yearlings there as well. It's obviously growing at a very fast rate. Was this expected? Was that planned, that this was sort of, you know, this was the trajectory you wanted to be going at?
You know, like, you just have to know me. Like, I started my firm in 2018, and, you know, I'm raising more capital now. And when I meet with investors, they're like, man, you've done a lot in a short period of time, you know, $3.5 billion of assets in all of these companies that you own. And I don't do anything halfway. Like, I was never going to just own a couple of horses, you know. And so when I decided to get all in, I went all in. You know, we have 187 horses today. Every horse that I bought at auction, I bought 4 that people don't know about. So, and I have some pretty special horses. I mean, I've really cultivated a really good selection of broodmares already. I brought broodmares from, you know, multiple continents already, you know, back to the U.S. to, you know, kind of replenish the broodmare band. And that's one of my big missions.
Yeah, as you said, you've made some investments in other countries and bought a couple of broodmares over and that sort of thing. Could you tell us a little bit about your strategy and what your ambitions are in racing for the short and for the long term?
Yeah, so my number one ambition is to contribute to the sport in a positive way. So, like, you know, if you use that as like the way that you try to judge how what you're doing, it makes things a lot easier. You know, I'm actually, you know, I want to, of course, do we want to run races? Sure. Do we want to be, you know, get breeder awards and win all those things? Sure, we do. Sure, we want to do all those things. But, you know, I've grown up enjoying horse racing, and now I'm at a point where I can invest in it. And so I'm doing it because I want the next generation of people to be able to enjoy horse racing the way I've enjoyed horse racing. And horse racing, you know, has problems globally and in America. You know, we have problems in horse racing. Every industry has problems. And, you know, I think the industry is too hard on themselves. A lot of people in the industry, they talk about, you know, horse racing's on the decline and the foal population's down. You know, there's 1,000 problems. There's not one silver bullet that's going to fix them. And I think some new ideas, some fresh ideas are, you know, something that the industry could benefit from. It's something that helps me in my business. You know, I buy companies all the time, and I don't understand the end market as well as the former owner or even the management team that runs the business. But I've owned all kinds of businesses over 17 years. And so I bring a lot of expertise, even though I'm not an expert at the industry that I'm going into. And so there's a very kind of methodical approach. And so what I do in those situations is I bring people in that are experts in the industry to provide me with data and information, but they don't make the decisions for me. I make the decisions. I just make it with the best data and the best information. And so I'm doing the same thing in the horse industry. And so my number one goal is just to contribute and make the sport better. I would say number two is I want to make the sport truly global. Like, I want global competition. You know, I want to take the best horses and I want to race them in the best races all over the world. And so 80% of my program right now is turf, because that's what you need to do to be in a global campaign. And that's something that a lot of American owners don't focus on. And so, you know, I'm excited about, you know, doing things like I bought Princess Calla, the horse of the year in South Africa, two-time Equus Award winner. And, you know, now we're hoping to get her to the Breeders' Cup. You know, it's a big ask of a horse, you know, of her age, and have to go through, you know, almost 120 days of quarantine to get her in condition that where she can go to the Breeders' Cup. But we're giving her the best chance to do that. And so that's exciting to me. I brought Tuta La Vida from Australia, and with the focus on having her in the Breeders' Cup this year. And, you know, I bought Fleetingly from Europe with the goal of having her in the Breeders' Cup this year. And so, you know, I got Didia from Argentina. You know, again, that's four horses, four different, you know, continents, you know, and all targeted for the Breeders' Cup this year. And of course, I have American horses, you know, I'm targeting to be in the Breeders' Cup. And so, you know, I'm trying to already do innovative things. I bought, you know, I bought Goliath, the number, you know, one turf horse in the world at the time that I bought him. And, you know, with the idea of going over and winning the Japan Cup and going to Hong Kong and going to Dubai and maybe bringing him to Australia next year and campaigning him down there. In taking him to all the best turf races and give the whole world, if he's really that good a horse, you know, then let's give everybody the opportunity to see him, let him run against all the best horses and answer all the questions.
I think a really important part of what you just said there as well was bringing that global approach. Initially, you mentioned about the next generation as well. And to bring in some of that next generation, we need to be having the best horses seen across the world and bringing that global approach and showing it's not just a segmented area, those who live in Victoria and Australia. It's not just, you know, the Melbourne Cup. There's so many good horses around the world. And yes, sometimes we race in different time zones, but what you're doing there is showing the success from other countries and that there are big Group One races and that there's horses just as good from all around the world. And it's awesome to see that you're shedding that light as well.
Well, you know, a lot of people, they talk smack about each other, right? You know, like, oh, the Americans, oh, those Australians, those horses, they can run down there. They're not any good here. And, you know, and then the Europeans, you know, are like, oh, the Americans, their horses can't compete in Europe. You know, well, the reason our horses don't compete in Europe is we don't take the good horses to Europe. I went to Royal Ascot this year, and I don't attend a race unless I have a runner, right? So, like, if you want to know when I'm going to be at the Everest, it's when I have a runner. And I'm looking for one, you know, but, you know, I'm not coming until I have something, you know, that I think has a legitimate chance to win. And so I went to Ascot this year. I bought three horses, and, you know, we didn't do very well. And the first thing I did is I told the team, we're coming back next year, and we're bringing all of our best horses. So I met with all of the American trainers and I told them, I said, I don't care if you've never been before, if you're going to have my horses, like, we're going to ask it. Like, and I, you know, and so you better, you know, be ready to go or otherwise I'm going to give my horses to somebody else. But I want to take the best horses and I want to go over there and I want to compete with the best horses and I'm not afraid of getting beat. To me, the most exciting thing about horse racing is when it's a grade one race and all of the top horses show up and they all run their best race. Right. And there's no excuses. Nobody got a bad trip or whatever. Everybody just goes and does their best because that's what's exciting as a fan.
Absolutely. Who would you say you admire most in racing? Has your approach been like inspired by any other operations or is it very much your own approach?
Well, look, I mean, you know, I have made friends with the Magners at Coolmore. And, you know, I bought horses from them and people are like, they're not really your friends. They're sharks, you know. But if you've ever met Tom, you know, down in Australia, Tom's like, you know, he's like the greatest guy in the world. Very good host. And we had just such a wonderful time when we were down there. You know, I really admire what their father and what their family has done with horse racing. You know, there's a lot of people that have made a lot of money and then get into horse racing. They actually have made a lot of money from horse racing. And I think they've really defined kind of the modern farm, you know, management system for breeders that operate on a global basis. I mean, when you go, whether you go to their operation in Australia or whether you go to their operation at Ballydoyle and at their farms in Tipperary or whether you come to America, you know, it's a very corporate kind of feel, you know, to how they manage and run the business. And, you know, of course, when I got in the business, everybody's like, you got to read the Horse Trader. And of course, that's the kind of the story of like how Coolmore got started. And I love the story because, you know, their most famous purchase was an accident, right? The dam of Sadler Wells was like, it was a fluke, right? It wasn't, they didn't go to Keeneland and want to buy it. It was, you know, the one of the friends that bought it and didn't have the money to pay for it. And then the partners kind of bailed them out, and it ends up being the Dam of Sadler Wells. And the same thing happened to me. I ended up buying the Dam of Pooka. The Dam of Mage Pooka. And so in America, you know, Pooka is one of only two horses ever to have two classic winners in America in the, you know, our dirt classic races. And it happened to be in back-to-back years with the same stallion, Good Magic. You know, at the time that I bought her, I had just spent $17 million the night before buying horses at Fasig Tipton. And I go over to Keeneland just to have dinner. And, you know, we run into some people and they're like, well, Pooka RNA'd. We go to the barn and I immediately cut a deal for $2.9 million and buy her. And Dornock at the time had not done anything. He just broke his maiden. And so now he wins the Belmont. He wins, you know, the Haskell and gets sold to Spendthrift. And now is a stallion. And Mage is already a stallion. And then we had a full brother born to both of them. And, you know, he's, you know, a real specimen. And, you know, I've already been offered about 10 times for someone to buy Pooka and her foal. And I'm not selling them. You know, they're not for sale. But again, it's kind of a fluke. I didn't like, you know, it wasn't like a plan, you know, to buy her. I didn't even attend the sale where she was for sale. And there's a lot of people in the industry that wish they would have bought her now.
You mentioned there about heavy investment in your broodmare band. Yeah, you know, you're talking about that mare there. Goodnight Olive for $6 million. It takes a long time to bring that money back in, especially on the racetrack, or whether it's through a sales ring or via the progeny's earnings, whatever it may be. Obviously, you mentioned enjoyment is a big part of your passion for racing. Is the aim for this to also be profitable?
Oh, 100%. 100%. I mean, look, if you look at the value of the stock and how much it's appreciated over a year, it's already profitable for me. You know, like these horses are, you know, I bought horses that were in foal, that have had foals, that, you know, have already, you know, the fact that I'm not a big seller, you know, I am going to sell a few horses, you know, I'm going to, you know, I've adapted my system over kind of the first 6 months I was in here. And some of the ones I have, you know, don't really fit my system or whatever. And so I'll move some things along, you know, over time. And some of the initial breedings that when we bought horses, they were already in foal. And we didn't do the matings. And so we might move some of those on, you know, to other people. But it's not that I'm never going to sell anything, because, you know, at some point you have to just to control your numbers and you have to cull, you know, horses and everything. But I'm still trying to like build families, you know, like some of the established farms. And, you know, I've already done a lot of work in that. But, you know, over time we will sell, but that's not the focus. Like I want the focus to be the racing. And so I think that gives me a whole different advantage, because I don't have to do everything that everybody does just from a commercial aspect. Like I don't have to fold my foals at the same time everybody else does, because I don't have to get them ready for a sale. I don't have to, you know, throw my yearlings into like this program or whatever, because I have to get them in a sale. I don't have to like put them on walkers and, you know, take all that cosmetic surgeries and stuff to try to make them look perfect, because I'm putting them in a cell. I can let a horse be a horse. And I think, you know, that there's some benefit to that, you know, for the health of the horse, you know, to not put them through that commercial side of things, you know, in their first 2 years. If you think about from a breeder standpoint, people breed them, they sell them as weanlings when they're 6 to 9 months old, then they're sold again as yearlings. And then they could be sold again as a 2-year-old, you know, and all at the, you know, the beginning of their career, it's all based on the commercial appeal and what they end up looking like. And we all know that, you know, confirmation means nothing when they line up in the starting gate.
You mentioned earlier about the gelded Goliath. We know he's a King George Stakes winner. As mentioned there, he is a gelding, and he doesn't have any stallion potential. He's not a broodmare. How does I'm assuming it's based on enjoyment, but in terms of buying into a gelding, how does that fit into your strategy, and what are your plans for Goliath? You mentioned he might be coming over to Australia.
Yeah, so there's two advantages that I have. One is no other breeder wants to buy that horse. And if you want to control the horse, you don't have to buy 100% of it, because there's no residual value, right? So, you know, buying the majority share of Goliath and cutting the deal for him so I could control his career. I mean, look, I could, if I win the Japan Cup or any of those races, I'll more than make back you know, the money that I made on buying him, right? So I have like an advantage because nobody else is actually looking to acquire those horses. So I'm like almost have no competition when I'm going out to buy them. And I'm not doing it just for my enjoyment. I'm doing it to show my commitment to making this sport global, right? Like I'm in it, you know, I'll be in it for just, you know, a little over a year, and I'll already had a horse in the Kentucky Derby. I'll already had a horse at Ascot, and I'll already have a horse in the Japan Cup. You know, I mean, it's a dedication to really trying to be a competitor on a global basis and giving the fans what they want. I think the Japanese fans, that I think if I'm them, they're tired of all the Japanese horses winning all the time. And they would love to see some of the, because they're great admirers of the sport. And so I think they would love to see Goliath as, you know, the, you know, top ranked turf horse in the world come over and compete in that race. I think for them, it's going to create a lot of excitement. And, you know, we're doing some things to like get more fan engagement in the sport. And I have a whole campaign around Goliath that I think everybody's going to love. And I can't tell you any more details, but after once we have it all kind of lined out, but going into the Japan Cup, we have a whole commercial strategy with merchandise around him and everything that I think is going to create a lot of fun and excitement. And it's, you know, everything that you do in life doesn't have to be about making money. You know, it'll be good to cover some costs and, you know, do those types of things, but it's more about, you know, just showing people my dedication to the industry and making this a truly global sport.
Social media is obviously a big part of being able to engage fans. And one thing you've recently done is invited 5 fans to join you in your pre-sale meeting at Keeneland September. How important is transparency for you to engage fans, and how important is it for the wider industry to sort of take that approach as well?
I think it's very important because, look, number one, like this sport doesn't exist without the punters, right? And in most sports, like there's a list of injuries, and you get to know that when you bet on the sports. And, you know, the horse industry is not very transparent about that. You know, people are worried about the value of the horse if you tell people what's going on. And, you know, I'm working right now, you know, to put on our website an injury list. And so that people know, like if our horse, you know, if they got shins or if they have, you know, ankle chip or whatever, I first of all, I think the punters deserve to know the injury. And I think, you know, like if a horse has an ankle chip, which is a pretty routine injury with a pretty routine recovery, you know, people can kind of understand what that looks like. And so I think there's just too much mystery about it. I think people are worried about people, you know, that are against horse racing, using that as ammunition against them. And look, injuries happen all the time. Bad things happen. Horses break down in the industry. That happens, unfortunately. But it's not that the bad thing happens. It's how we respond to it. And so I think when you're transparent and people can see, like they can see that the owner cares, and they can see that the trainer cares, and they can see that the groom, you know, is, you know, grief stricken and, you know, those types of things. It really helps to fill in the blanks of the story, because unfortunately, whether we're transparent or not, people are going to make up their own minds. And so I'm just trying to give them more data and more information. And so I think the fans want that. I mean, already we've had a lot of success with engaging fans in that. And like they had unfettered access when they were there. I mean, I had people on my team, oh, we're not going to really tell them the horses we want to buy. They could be plants for people and, you know, whatever. I'm like, guys, it's a public auction. Like once we bid, everybody's going to know. So it doesn't really matter. And so we shared with them all of the analytics that we use, all the data behind it. You know, we had 2 people drive 5 hours to come down and be a part of it. And, you know, we didn't cover their housing, so they had to put up their own hotel room and everything. And so these were real dedicated people that, you know, were interested in what we did. And they got to attend the sale with us and wear Resolute gear and be like a part of our team and sit with us while we bid. And, you know, so I think it was really good for them. And at the Breeders' Cup this year, I actually got a suite for 120 people for the fans. And so I've arranged it with the Breeders' Cup because everybody's talking about how expensive it is. And so we're going to be doing an online sign up, and anybody can sign up, and we're going to be bringing the fans to a VIP experience. And all we're asking them to do is make at least $100 donation to Thoroughbred Aftercare. And we're going to cover all the costs. It's going to be, you know, catered food and drink and, You know, that we'll have trainers and jockeys coming and interacting with the fans, but we're trying to create a whole fan experience and, you know, doing it to benefit a really good cause and raise attention to a cause that needs to have that done in the industry.
That's an amazing initiative. That is awesome. And I think that will go a long way with the fans and people really appreciate that. So that's awesome. Going off that transparency approach that you have, you also broadcast how much you intended to bid on the Winx Filly English Easter sale this year. Could you talk us through a little bit your thought process behind being so open in that situation when most bidders on a horse like that would keep their cards very close to their chest?
Well, that's just not how I play the game. I openly tell people about the horses that I'm interested in. And, you know, people are like, oh, well, then people are going to take advantage of you. Well, you know, that actually hasn't happened. I have really prominent people in the industry that now send me a list of horses before the sale and say, are you interested in any of these? Because if you are, we're just out, you know, because they know I'm not going to stop, you know, once I start. And, you know, on the Winx Filly, I told everybody I'd go to 9 million. And if it went to 10, like someone else could have her. And that's exactly what I ended up doing. And, you know, look, I thought it was good fun. I was trying to introduce myself to the Australian, you know, racing fans and let them know who I was and maybe be excited about us and our venture and dipping our toe in the water with six yearlings down in Australia, which is just the beginning. You know, we will have more, 100% guaranteed. But, you know, look, at the end of the day, I got a lot of press and publicity and I didn't have to spend $9 million for a horse. So, you know, seemed like a pretty good plan now.
How did you find all that period? Obviously there was a big lead up to the filly going through the ring. There was a lot of social media presence, a lot of stuff on TV, made national news over here. Being involved in that process, is that a pretty cool experience for obviously Taylor and myself have never been involved in the bidding process, let alone going for something for, you know, that sells for $10 million. It must get the heart rate going at the least.
Yeah, look, I mean, I had it was funny because the day before I was bidding on a horse and we lost the internet connection. And so I was talking with Mark at Inglis. And so I was on the phone with Mark and Chelsea was on the phone with somebody else as a backup. And we kind of had a watch party here in America. So we had a bunch of people in America watching the sale down in Australia, which I thought was really cool. And I already had my bids planned. You know, because, you know, I think at the time, $2.5 million was the record for a filly as a yearling. And then $5 million was the record for a yearling at all. And the $2.5 million was my first bid. $5 million was my second bid. And then, you know, my goal was for the horse not to go to the Japanese. And I don't have anything against the Japanese. I worked for a Japanese company. I have a lot of respect for them. But in the horse industry, the horses go away. Like they don't ever come back. Like once the good brood mares or the good horses go to Japan, we don't ever see them again. It's not like, you know, we can go over there and buy the best of the best like they can in Australia and in America. And so I think until they kind of open things up, I kind of want to make the statement that, like, you know, I'm going to go over and try to win their money and bring it back over here or take it to Australia and keep them from buying the good horses and taking them to Japan. You know, they're going to have to deal with the John Stewart tax, you know, on these mares. So, you know, part of it was about that. And I thought the Winx Filly was so important to Australian racing fans that I thought she needed to stay in Australia. And so I had met Debbie before the sale and I had asked her, I said, oh, I met her at Coolmore because we're partners in Stormboy together. And I said, you know, Debbie, are you going to buy the horse? And she said, she told me no, that, you know, she was selling it and that she didn't intend to. And I said, well, you know, like I know that the, you know, because the Japanese have been at Coolmore a lot looking at the horse. And I said, Debbie, I said, if you need a partner, you know, I'd be happy to partner with you. And she's like, I said, I think the horse needs to stay in Australia. And she's like, well, you're not even Australian. And I was like, okay, well, that didn't go over well. And so then that's when I decided to bid on the horse because I thought she wasn't going to buy it. And even up to the beginning of the sale, she was telling people she wasn't buying the horse. And I literally stepped off the gas on my bidding because I found out from somebody that was there that it was Debbie who I was bidding against. And at that point I said, well, if Debbie wants it, I'm not running the price up on her anymore. And so I'm done.
If you had have won the filly, would you have sent it to Chris Waller?
Absolutely. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Beautiful. And as well, just during that period, there was obviously, I've never been in a sales ring where the whole ring has gone completely silent. Once it hit 5.5 million, 6 million, when you're bidding, obviously via the phone and watching via a live stream, can you sense that the room is absolutely packed? There's a sort of a gush after every bid, yeah. 6 million, 7 million. Everyone's like, oh, like it must be just incredible to be again just involved in that type of experience as well.
Yeah, no, it was fun. I enjoyed it, and I had every intention of owning the horse. I would have paid 9 million for it. I had no problem doing that. And look, I think it's great for the sport. I think it generated a lot of buzz, and you know, I tried to participate in the interviews and you know everything. And you know, I did my part of playing the kind of brash American that's like gonna say he's buying the horse, right? So you know, it got people interested. I think some people watched that probably wouldn't have watched it before, and I think that's good for the sport. And so you know, look, I like I said, I want to do positive things for the sport. I'm glad Debbie ended up with the horse. I'm completely fine. I don't have any like ill will towards that at all. But you know, I similar, you know, things here in America, you know, I have the similar situation, you know, when I start bidding on a horse here. And I usually don't give up on a bid. And there was a couple this year at Keeneland, and I did, you know, give up. And they're like, the auctioneer's like, well, that's not like you, you know, because I gave up on a couple. But again, you know, I got to control my numbers at some point. There's 4,000 or 5,000 horses at the Keeneland sale. I mean, they're still going now, you know, at the sale. And so like, you know, there's a lot of good ones. You can go every day. And I just have to like, keep my team away because they'll be coming to me and, oh, we got to have this one. This is the one. And, you know, and next thing you know, we'll have 250 horses if we're not careful.
As you mentioned earlier, you're a passionate advocate for thoroughbred aftercare and saved some horses from pens. And of course, raising money in this space is something that you've said you're quite passionate about. Could you explain why this is so important to you and what your ambitions are on this front?
Yeah, look, when I got into the sport, I was unaware of this problem and it disgusts me. I mean, it literally disgusts me because I view these horses as athletes. And, you know, for people just to discard them, I mean, I rescued two horses in May. They ran on the track in May. They literally ran. One of the horses won $250,000. And then someone, you know, and we know who it was because the data is available, but the trainer just took the horses and dumped them in kill pens to be shipped to Mexico, which is illegal in America to ship the horses to Mexico for slaughter. That's not legal. And, they pretend that that's not what's happening, but that's exactly what's happening. And, you know, just drop the horses at the kill pens. And so, you know, we became aware of it and, you know, I wish I could save every one of them, and I'm working on a plan to save a lot more of them. I'm going to buy a farm, you know, that I can, you know, make a dent in the problem until I can make sure the problem is solved. And, you know, there's other owners up here. They're very passionate about this as well. And I think, you know, we may have differences over other things, but we can come together about this problem. And these horses deserve better than that, you know, at the end of the day. And I posted a picture on my Twitter this week, that horse that I saved. And you see him today. It's like a completely different horse. And I'll tell you, I've won a grade one this year already. And so it's a much better feeling when I walk out to the paddock and I see that horse, because when we first got him there, he wouldn't even look at us in the eye. Like those, you know, just think about like being rejected, you know, and being put in a situation where you know that you're not, you know, wanted, and that you're, you know, those horses know what's going on. They're smart. And then, you know, they would shy away from us. They didn't really trust us. And now they come up to us, they hold their head up high, you know, they look fantastic. You know, because the rule on Resolute Farm is whether you cost $6 million or whether you came from a kill pen, you get treated exactly the same. You get the same food, you get the same medicine, you get the same, you get turned out, you get groomed, you get everything exactly the same. Every horse gets the exact same treatment on our farm. You know, it's some of the things that make me the happiest is being able to have an impact on animals like that. And so, you know, there's a lot more work to do. You know, it literally disgusts me. I've already hired a team of private investigators that are following all of these people around. We've put in GPS sensors on people's vehicles and we've tracked them. We know where they're going in Mexico. I mean, I'm gathering all the information, and these people may be getting away from it a little time, but their time is coming. And, you know, whether it comes to me having to buy all the kill pens and shutting them down or whatever I have to do, I'm going to solve this problem. I mean, it's going to get solved.
Amazing to see that you're so passionate about that, and yeah, they're special animals. But on an Australian front, speaking of special fillies, you did buy a filly at Easter this year. She's out of Booker. You bought her at the English Easter sale and now in the care of Chris Waller. How's this filly tracking and how do you find working with Chris as well?
I mean, look, that's one of the things I really admire. All the Australian trainers, the communication is amazing. You know, and the American trainers could learn a lot from the Australian trainers. I get a video every week of the horses and Chris, and he's talking to us like personally, you know, and telling us what's going on with the horse and, you know, what's going on. And, you know, I took Tuta La Vida that he had, you know, ready for the Queensland Oaks away from him to bring her up here, you know, to run in the Breeders' Cup. And he's completely supportive of like that global idea and the global campaign. He wasn't upset about it. You know, he's worked with her trainer up here to get her acclimated. And so the trainers are just fantastic. The communication is fantastic. And I know that they have a lot of horses that they train, but they do a really good job interacting with the owners and providing information. You know, even Storm Boy with Gay's team, you know, we get, you know, regular updates from them, you know, on what's going on. And like, you know, if we reach out to them, they're very responsive. And, you know, I think that's what you want as an owner. You want to make sure that, you know, these horses are well taken care of and they're being given every opportunity to be successful. And I'm confident, you know, with all of the trainers that we selected in Australia that we're going to see that. And then at the same point, I've told all the trainers the same thing. You guys are all accomplished, but you haven't done anything for me yet. So if you want more horses for me in the future, well, here's your chance. Let's see who does what with these horses that I gave them. And then when I buy the next round of horses, the people that accomplish more with those horses are going to be the one to get more horses.
For sure. You mentioned Tuta La Vida. How is she going? And you mentioned she's on a Breeders' Cup preparation.
Yeah, look, I mean, so I have her with Ignacio Correas. He's an Argentinian trainer, so he knows about bringing these Southern Hemisphere horses up to North America. We did that with Didia, who's our grade one horse up here. So it takes a little special routine to kind of get them acclimated to North America. And, you know, because they're coming, you know, out of, you know, your winter into your spring and they're coming into our fall. And, you know, so they have to like deal with all of that situation. But she's breezing now and doing well, you know, and so we seem pretty happy with her. We're going to try to get her for the Breeders' Cup. I am not going to run her if she's not up to form, right? Because that'd be a disservice to her, you know, so I'm not going to rush anything. We are trying to make the timing. And at the end of the day, Ignacio will make the call. But, you know, we are targeting to have her in the Breeders' Cup. She will be accepted in the Breeders' Cup. You know, we've already talked to them about that if she's ready to go. But, you know, we've got a little over a month and she's already, you know, breathing, you know, 3/8 of a mile and she's doing well and she's handling it well. And, you know, she's a really sound horse. So, you know, hopefully we get her to the point that Ignacio's comfortable thinking that she can, you know, run a good race. And, you know, the last thing I want to do is bring her up from Australia and then she comes in last and everybody's talking smack about Australian horses, which will do exactly the opposite to what I want it to do. So I'm going to make sure she doesn't run unless I'm 100% confident that she's going to be at her top form.
You mentioned as well before about Storm Boy being involved in what is one of Australia's banner 3-year-olds heading towards a Golden Rose and obviously some big Group 1 spring targets. He's a potential stallion at Coolmore. He is going to be a stallion at Coolmore.
You better be.
he's by Justify, one of the world's best stallions, as we know. What was the reason behind buying into him? I'm assuming, again, it's to be involved in the best and race against the best.
Yeah, look, you know, I had got to know the Coolmore guys. I was at the Pegasus races in Miami, and I was having dinner with them. MV had just come back. His, you know, wife is Australian, and so they spend the holiday down there. He comes back and he's telling me about this horse that, and I didn't know Storm Boy at the time, you know, he's telling me about this horse and that they just bought him and they, you know, spent all this money on him. And, you know, and I was like, oh, I'll take a share if you got one. And he's like, are you serious? I'm like, sure. You know? And so, so I bought a share in him and then, you know, I had some business down in Australia. So I timed it to come down for the Golden Slipper, you know, and he didn't run well, which is that happens, you know. They're horses at the end of the day. And, you know, that 2-year-old campaign that you guys have, I mean, our 3-year-old campaign in America is tough, but yours is tough. I mean, those races come back to back to back. And, you know, for a horse to win the Triple Crown in Australia, like they have to be some kind of phenomenal athlete, you know, to kind of endure all of that because they've already been tested just to get there. Right. And so, you know, he needed a little rest. He looks fantastic. You know, he's quite a large horse. You know, Gay said she's going to ask for an accommodation for a little larger starting you know, gate because he was a little cramped and didn't get out good in the last race. And she thinks that was a little bit of the problem there. But, you know, look, it's exciting. It's all exciting. There was a lot of hype around Storm Boy going in the Golden Slipper, even though he didn't pull it off, you know. But so that was fun to be a part of all of that. And look, just the chance to, like I said, work with Tom from Coolmore. I would buy anything that Tom was selling. Like, I mean, he's just that good of a salesperson. Like, you know, you just want to be around Tom. He's fun to be around. He's a good host, you know, and, you know, that's, again, that's part of why you do this is to, you know, meet new people and be around people. And, you know, Tom Magner is like, you know, one of those people that you just want to spend more time with.
In terms of your purchases at the Australian Easter sale, is there one in particular, one 2-year-old in particular, that any Australian listener here should keep an eye on this spring carnival?
I think the Done Deal colt. Yeah, I think people like should watch out for him. I think like he was underestimated. And you know, my horseman Gavin, he can pick horses. I mean he can pick a horse. He's done a really, really good job. And you know, when he we have like a 3-part system that we use. I use all the data analytics, and then Chelsea looks at their, you know, their actual like pedigree, and she looks at their physicals, and then Gavin looks at their physicals. And when all three of us come together on a horse, like it everything lines up really good. You know, those are the horses we absolutely have to buy. And then sometimes we'll take a flyer on one I like and they don't, and one that they like and I don't. But the Done Deal colt was one that we all liked, you know? And so I think he could be really special. Of course, the Booker Philly gets, you know, all the attention. And, you know, I think we're going to have a lot of good fun with all of them. And hopefully they're, you know, they all are sound and, you know, and are able to take advantage of, you know, the opportunities with the trainer. But right now they're all progressing and, you know, we're excited for all of them. We just need some people in Australia to wear some of our Resolute gear to the races and go to the winner's circle for us when we're not there. So if any of your listeners are out there up for it, hit us up on the direct message on Twitter and we'll get you guys hooked up.
Absolutely. I'm sure us at ANZ would be more than happy to do that as well. We're into our just last segment here. It's called Fast Five. Just a couple of quick fire questions just to get to know you a little bit more. Taylor, you kick us off.
So John, what is a racetrack that you've never been to around the world that you'd love to attend?
I would say the Dubai World Cup. Yeah, that track.
Who was an idol of yours through your teenage and young adult years?
Superman.
That's a great one. If you could win one race around the world, what race would that be?
The Everest.
We love it. If you could sit at a dinner table with 3 people of your choice, who are they? Past or present?
I would probably pick John Magner, because I kind of respect what he's like done in the industry. Nikola Tesla, because I'm like a science guy, and I think, you know, he went way before his time and had a lot more to teach us. And probably, I don't know, maybe John F. Kennedy, one of the president that left too early too. So all 3 kind of great people that it would be good to know.
And last one, if you're having a night out for dinner, what is your cuisine of choice?
Italian. I'm half Italian, so I love Italian food, love pasta. So I'm actually going to an Italian restaurant with my kids tonight. So we're excited about that.
John, thank you so much for joining us today on the Business of Bloodstock. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Certainly hearing how you've built your business and your impact on racing and breeding and what you do, what you're looking to do in the future as well. It's certainly something that we can do better in Australia as well, and I hope that people do after listening to this. So again, John, thank you so much for taking the time to come on and join us.
Yeah, and we'd love to have any of your fans join us at the Breeders' Cup. So if they're willing to make the trip, I'm willing to provide them with the first class experience.
Amazing. Thank you so much, mate.
All right, thanks. Cheers.
Cheers, John.
Thanks, John.